Welcome to Law Talk, the Legal Scholarship Podcast. I'm your host, Nathan Oman, Assistant Professor at William & Mary Law School. You can find Law Talk online at www.concurringopinions.com. Just look on the left side of the page under the Categories heading and click on Law Talk. There you can find past episodes as well as information on how to subscribe. My guest today is Professor Gordon Smith. Gordon is a professor at BYU's J. Reuben Clark Law School, where he just moved, and before that he was at the University of Wisconsin and Lewis and Clark Law School. You've visited various other places, haven't you, Gordon?
I have. Too many to mention.
Well, we can keep that short then. Today we want to talk about some of Gordon's recent research in that most interesting of all fields, contracts. In particular, you have a paper that's up on SSRN, Contract as Organization. Has that been accepted for publication anyplace?
No, we sent out a early version of it in the spring to a few law reviews and didn't get the enthusiastic response that we were sure was coming, so we're revising it this semester and sending it out in the spring.
Now, when you say we, you have a co-author on that, Braden King.
Correct. Yes, Braden's actually also here at BYU. He's a sociology professor.
Well, if you can tell, sort of summarize, what is your argument or your thesis in that paper, if you had to distill it down to a couple of sentences or a paragraph?
Well, we're making a pitch for law professors to do empirical work on contracts. And we're trying to provide people with some theoretical perspectives through which to view contracts, and in particular, we rely on organizational theory to provide those theoretical perspectives.
Now, when you say contracts, you don't necessarily mean contract law, right?
That's right. So we talk about the difference between what we're doing and what most people in law schools who write about contracts are doing. Most people aren't writing about contracts at all, but they're writing about what lawyers and judges do with contracts, and we're actually interested in the documents themselves.
Now, when most law professors, I think, who are aware of social science are most likely to be aware of economics, and when you look at the way economists frequently treat contracts, they say, well, they're agreements where people are trying to maximize their utility or expected payoff from the agreement, and in a world of zero transaction costs, they would bargain to a perfectly specified contract, which would, provide a rule of decision in every possible state of the world that would be value maximizing to the parties. And we relax that assumption and we look at contracts really in terms of the outcomes of parties attempting to completely specify their obligations subject to bargaining, the constraints of the cost of bargaining. You take a somewhat different approach.
Right. I think we all sort of recognize that contracts aren't complete, and that is, they're not fully specified for every contingency. And given that, the question is what's happening in the contracts. And I've actually written about contracts from an economic perspective. For example, I guess it's not just anymore, but I published an article that was a study of venture capital contracts in which I tried to explain the structure of venture capital contracts by reference to some economic theories. And I think they're very valuable that way because they give us insight into the governance provisions that parties use in the absence of full specification. So we see that parties are trying to figure out who makes decisions in certain circumstances. And in that particular article, I argued that venture capitalists and entrepreneurs actually have a form of contingent governance system that in which the control over the portfolio entity changes from the entrepreneur to the venture capitalist over time, and then eventually, according to Gilson and Black, back to the entrepreneur. And the parties provide for this sort of change in control rights through their contracts. So economic theory has been very powerful, and Braden and I don't want to say that it hasn't been very powerful. The impetus for this article was to say there might be more things going on than what economic theory tells us.
And what are some examples of those things?
Well, Well, we have in the last section of the article, we talk about the organizational perspectives, and we talk about the resource-based view of the firm, which is really a strategy concept. We talk about learning theory, identity theory, and then what organizational theorists call institutional theory, which we've labeled legitimacy and isomorphism. But for some reason, we thought legitimacy and isomorphism was more accessible than institutional theory, but I'm not sure that that's true. So what we say is that there are a lot of things going on in contracts that are that may have symbolic meaning. So, for example, we talk about some of Vic Fleischer's work with respect to branding in financial contracts, and talk about that as under the notion of identity.
So, what would be a sort of contract, concrete example of this symbolic branding aspect in a financial contract?
Okay, so we talk about, for example, the Pixar-Disney merger. And as part of that merger, Disney and Pixar created what they call the set of policies for the management. And the document is called Policies for Management of the Feature Animation Business. And it's a short document, but the thrust of the document is to maintain Pixar's culture. So, for example, it says that Pixar has to retain its name separate from Disney, that it's developed its own brand and it wants to keep that. It has to keep its own headquarters. And there's a Pixar sign outside the gate to the headquarters, and Disney can't take that sign down. And to us, that looked a lot like branding or a identity provision, not necessarily provision designed to reduce transaction costs or police opportunism or do the other things we traditionally associate with the economic analysis of contracts.
What about learning theory, for example? How does the design of a contract intersect with that notion?
Yeah, so learning theory is actually really rich and interesting, and there's a lot of things going on there. And I guess I should say that one of the things that we're trying to do here is just present these as potential ideas that people could use in their future studies of contracts. And so the notion of learning theory is really about how organizations learn over time. And we talk about organizations as adaptive learning systems. That's not our word. That's sort of the traditional view of organizations from Syard and March, who all the org theorists would read. But we're talking in here particularly about the notion that contracts might have some role in organizational learning. So we cite what I think is a really interesting and exciting recent study by Kyle Mayer and Nicholas, I don't know how to pronounce his name, but Nicholas Argyres of inter-firm contracts in the personal computing industry, and they refer to these contracts as repositories of knowledge. So one of the insights from learning theory is that you might study contracts over a period of time and see how the learning that firms do becomes embedded in the contract. That's not necessarily at odds in any way with economic analysis of contracts. In fact, it's sort of an evolutionary story about how contracts are shaped by experiences that parties have. But I think the organizational learning theory can tell us something about what organizations are doing, and study of contracts can tell us something about learning theory. That is, they're doing it through contracts. So organizational scholars have just started to do what we're suggesting in this article more law scholars should do, which is to look at actual contracts for insights about their theories or about contracts. So this is a little bit confusing, but we see this sort of going both ways. You can look for the contracts for insights about your particular theory. So if you're a learning theorist, you can get some insights about learning theory from looking at contracts. But if you're interested in contracts, you can get some insights about what's going on there from learning theory.
It's interesting. When I read that part of your paper, I thought immediately of insurance contracts and commercial lending agreements, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have a lot of standard provisions. And in the insurance industry, right, the provisions in the insurance contracts are frequently drafted by industry groups,
right.
Copyrighted, and then sold to the various carriers. And the language becomes valuable because once the language has been interpreted by a court, you can have a fair degree of certainty about what the language means. And so you get over time the accretion of language in insurance contracts where the language of the contract itself sort of instantiates the legal learning about how the courts are going to be interpreting that particular contract. And you see similar...
Yeah, exactly right. This is Michelle Bortman's paper, I think it sounds like. Is that right? Is that the...
Yeah, she did a great paper on this when Michigan did its symposium on boilerplate contracts.
And I think that we actually cite that paper in our paper as an example of how you might, think about learning theory. And the, in particular, there we're talking about, again, what the organizational theorists would call population level learning. So this is learning not at a single organizational level, but at a population of organizations. So in that case, insurance companies. And, I think this is for lawyers, probably a common observation that populations of organizations learn from each other and adapt through their modification of their contracts. In fact, most of the boilerplate literature on boilerplate contracts has essentially that same sort of at least implicit assumption, if not explicit, that that's what's going on.
Well, there's obviously alternative stories that people tell about boilerplate contracts, right?
Mm-hmm.
Going back to Kessler or Dawson, the notion that it's just about the party with the most power in the bargaining relationship, in effect, imposing their terms on whatever else on the other party, simply to maximize their payoff. But seems the learning theory allows you to tell a somewhat more nuanced story about what's going on with those contracts.
Mm-hmm. Well, we hope so. And I think the next step for us from here is to actually do some of the empirical work, and we've started to do that. We've launched a project in which we're looking at artisanal cheesemakers in Wisconsin, and it's probably not too hard to figure out why that was attractive to me, but it's a little bit more difficult to do that study now that I'm in Utah, so I picked a particularly bad time to move, but at least it'll get me back to Wisconsin and maybe to sample a little bit of cheese.
Then the cheese-making culture in Utah, you're finding, is not quite as developed as it was in Wisconsin.
It's not. It's very tough to find good cheese here.
I'm sorry to hear that.
I'm sure it exists, but I just haven't been able to find it yet.
Now, when you say you want to do more empirical studies, how do you envision yourself sort of structuring those? Are you going to try and do just intensive studies of maybe the contracts of one or two companies, or try and sweep broadly through an entire industry? Have you worked out how those studies are going to be designed?
The ones that I've imagined so far are relatively small groups of contracts that, or the studies of small organizations that should have some features that make them relatively homogenous, and then looking at the contracts of those organizations. So the artisanal cheesemakers are engaged in the business models of these 50 or so companies in Wisconsin that we've identified look pretty similar. And so we're going to look at the organizational structure first to see if there's anything interesting to say about the organizational structure of those firms. Because one of the things we noticed, and this is what prompted us to begin looking at the artisanal cheesemakers, is that they're organized in different ways. Some are organized as corporations, some are organized as limited liability companies, some are organized as cooperatives. And I thought that, as a business organization scholar, I thought that was an interesting observation, that these companies that are essentially doing the same thing would organize in different ways, and I wondered why they would do that.
Do you have any theories about why they would choose one form over another?
Well, one of the possibilities here is, I mean, there could be something very mundane that we haven't discovered yet. We've been asking around among the cheesemakers and lawyers for the cheesemakers about why this would happen, and nobody's come up with the killer obvious explanation, like a particular tax regulation that might explain the pattern of organization. One of the theories we have heard from people is that there may be some identification going on, so the identity theory would come into play here, that some of these firms are organizing, for example, as cooperatives because they want to identify themselves with the values of business cooperatives. So that is the sort of egalitarianism, communitarianism, that sort of ethos, and that these cheesemakers may want to embrace that notion. It could be a more of a marketing thing. We don't, again, it's hard yet. We're still going to, we've got a lot of interviews in front of us, but it could just be that people are, you know, there are a combination of things going on, between governance provisions, tax, planning, marketing, and, you know, maybe a little bit of, identity shaping going on. We're not sure yet, but we've got some ideas that way.
So the literatures that you're drawing on in the contractors organization are largely sociological and behavioral theorists, and the methods that you're using, or you're talking about using these studies, are very different than the sort of things, obviously, that you, I'm assuming, you learned in law school.
Yes.
And you've teamed up with Braden King to do this research. What can you tell me a little bit about Braden and how it was that you hooked up with him, and what you are, what the experience is like is collaborating across disciplinary lines that way?
Well, Braden is a young sociologist. He's here at BYU, and he was, we became acquainted over the internet. He was somebody who commented over on Times and Seasons pretty frequently in the early days there, and then formed his own blog, which is orgtheory.net. And I found that orgtheory.net was one of the blogs I would regularly read and occasionally comment on. And then I found that Braden was reading our blog, Conglomerate, and commenting on that. And we started to exchange emails, and then we started to trade drafts of papers, and one thing led to another. And I said, well, why don't we write this article on that I'd been sort of contemplating, write an article about how we might look at contracts other than through an economic lens. So that's how it got started. And Braden was quite enthusiastic about that. So he was sort of helped me to get up to speed on the organizational theory. So I spent a lot of time reading textbooks and articles. And it's actually a very accessible, for a law professor, a very accessible literature. Most of it is not, it's not highly quantitative. A lot of it is very theoretical, conceptual. So it was quite interesting and accessible in large part by me. So that was appealing as well. And it seemed to have, it appealed to me in another way, and that is, after reading hundreds of venture capital contracts, I felt like I understood some aspects of the venture capital contracting process, but there were other aspects which didn't come as easily to me, or weren't as clear to me. And I thought some of the organizational literature was helpful in explaining what was going on in that industry. So it was appealing from that perspective.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that for this article, so this is really a conceptual article, so we didn't really have to do anything methodologically that was unfamiliar to a law professor. It was reading lots of articles, in this case in another discipline, and talking about how they might relate to the empirical study of contracts. We tried to take examples of empirical studies from the existing literature, but also to suggest that there was a lot more potential for work here. Now, as we get into the other projects, for example, the project on the artisanal cheesemakers, that's where we're going to have to, I'm going to have to get out of my office and actually go visit some cheesemakers and interview them and gather the information that way. And so that's going to be a bigger stretch.
Now, as you were collaborating with Brayton, what did you notice that you, either of you had particular sorts of areas of expertise or advantage that you were bringing to the project? Just wondering what you see as the value added that both of you bring based on your disciplinary backgrounds, and maybe what are maybe advantages or disadvantages of doing this kind of collaborative work.
Yeah, I thought it was it has been and continues to be a great learning experience. Now that I'm here, I can see Brayton more often, and I just had lunch with him last week. And I think the obvious divide here is that I was a transactional lawyer, and so I've seen a lot of contracts. I've also studied them since getting into academia. So this has been something that I've done a lot of. Brayton has not spent a lot of time reading contracts, and I think if he had his druthers, he would, you know, live his whole life and not spend a lot of time reading contract documents, and would just as soon leave that to other people. But I think that so that was sort of my area of advantage, and his area of advantage, of course, was that he was steeped in org theory and could help me to conceptualize, particularly the last part of the article where we talked about different approaches that we might take to looking at contracts. So the way this started is that I described to him some of the issues I was having with the venture capital agreement, some of the things that I thought were interesting, but not necessarily things that I had written about, because they just didn't fit with the particular articles that I was writing. And he would say, well, that sounds like, you know, there may be an isomorphism story there, or there might be a learning story there or something. So he was trying to help me to get the real world of contracts categorized into some boxes that would help us gain some insights about those contracts.
Now, this up to this point, the way you've described this, it sounds very much as a sort of sociological or social scientific type project. And the question that the lawyers always want to ask, right, is, well, is there a normative payoff here? I mean, when you do all of this research and you understand the contracting process better, does that connect back to your analysis of the content of the law regulating these contracts and how it maybe doing its job well, or how it might be improved or changed? Do you see the project having any normative implications?
It might. Let me suggest two possibilities here. One would be for transactional lawyers. So to the extent we're interested in teaching transactional lawyering, I think that projects like this are essential. And I think it's essential, frankly, that lawyers and law professors get involved in doing empirical work on contracts, because I've read enough of the empirical studies of mostly economists. One of the things we do in the paper is look at who does this sort of work, and it's almost exclusively done by economists. And economists are great folks. Some of my best friends are economists, but they don't always understand the contracts that they're reading as a lawyer would understand them. And I think that the result is that they sometimes miss things, oftentimes miss big things. And
what can you think of concrete examples of things that you've seen missed in studies that would be clear to a lawyer?
Well, I can think of one very vivid example, because I wrote about it in my UCLA piece on venture capital contracts, and that is that the sort of standard account of venture capital contracts interpreted a provision in those contracts to say that boards of venture-backed companies were determined jointly by venture capitalists and entrepreneurs. When I looked at the contracts in my data set, I found very few provisions in which the venture capitalists and entrepreneurs jointly determine the tie-breaking directors or independent directors on venture-backed boards. Those typically were elected, at least as a formal matter, by either the venture capitalist or the entrepreneur, but not by them jointly. Now, I know that Brian Brofman at Berkeley actually has a working paper out in which he suggests that these sorts of joint provisions may be more common than I suggested in my piece. But out of all of the contracts that I looked at 367. Not all of them. I wasn't able to find the board of directors provision in all of them, but I was able to find it in a lot of them, and I think I found a joint provision in, well, now I'd have to go back and look at the numbers, but less than a handful. So, and I asked several of the economists who had done, well, at least one of the economists who had done the most famous earlier study about it, and response I got was that looks like it maybe it was miscoded. So that was a pretty dramatic example of because it really quite changes your understanding of the board of directors if you think that the entrepreneurs and venture capitalists are jointly electing the tie-breaking directors as opposed to thinking that one party has control depending on how much stock they have.
So you see it as having the normative implications for how it is that you teach transactional lawyers and how transactional lawyers should think about
it. I think we don't teach much transactional law in law school. I think we should do more of that. And I think part of the reason that we don't teach much is that we don't have good we don't have good data on a lot of contracts. We don't have that much in terms of empirical work on contracts. So the more empirical work that's done, I think the more we'll see it taught. I think our theories about what happens in transactional work are, could use a little development. And I think they've undergone a great deal of development over the last couple of decades, but I see this as sort of expanding that. So that was the one, one implications for transactional work. The other would be, related to the other work I've been doing in law and entrepreneurship, and one of the things I'm interested in is whether states or countries can construct their legal regulations in a way that encourage entrepreneurial development. And one of the things that is interesting about doing empirical studies of contracts is that we understand more about how people who start up new businesses structure their relations in a formal legal sense. And this might be able to yield some insights. It might give us some insights about the regulation of those contracts. So if we can do comparative studies, for example, of German and U.S. venture capital agreements, that might be give us some interesting insight about the effect of regulation on contracting practices and might tell us something about what's good regulation and what's bad regulation with respect to economic development.
Now, one final question. The sorts of studies that you're describing, they sound like they are largely non-quantitative and sort of intensive case study analysis as opposed to creating more rigorous formal mathematical models. Am I sort of reading your research direction correctly?
Well,
there?
You can process the data more rigorously than I did, for example, in my venture capital piece. And I think it's certainly possible to do that. One of the challenges you face in doing this kind of work right away is getting your hands on contracts. And there are lots of contracts out there, but getting your hands on contracts that you're interested in seeing can be a pretty big challenge. And so getting a large number of of documents in the sample is sometimes difficult. So it makes the larger that number, the easier it is to do some number crunching with it. So that's one of the limitations. We've been doing small groups partly because it's really intensive to code contracts. It takes a lot of time to go through the venture capital contracts and code the different provisions just took an immense amount of time. And that's going to be true of most empirical projects and contracts. So, I suspect this is the reason more people don't do them. They're very time consuming.
And your approach is, your methodological approach has been driven more by practicality than by any particular methodological agenda that you have about how empirical research should be done. Is that fair? Do you have some sort of a methodological agenda?
I guess I would say it like this. In terms of, as a law professor, I'm interested in enhancing our understanding of contracting practices by studying what Mark Suchman would call the artifacts that result from those contracting relationships, which are the contracts themselves, the written documents. And so to the extent I have a methodological agenda, it's to bring us out of the period where we make assumptions about what people do in contracts based on anecdote, and we actually do studies of larger sets of real-world contracts to find out what people are doing. Now, as to what to do with those contracts, it's driven partly by an understanding of legal rules. So how do you code a contract? What's important to code and what's not important to code is partly driven by legal rules and partly driven by an understanding of the economics of a relationship. How you process that coding, what I did with the venture capital piece was did fairly impressionistic processing, right? So it was, 80% of the contracts have this sort of provision, or 50% have this sort of provision. So not doing correlations between provisions, just sort of offering some correctives with respect to the economic literature on that. You could do more sophisticated processing of the numbers once you get the codes. I'm not great at that stuff, so I've done a little bit of it, but I really need to team up with somebody to do that kind of work. And I think it'd be great to do it, and I think I'd encourage people who want to do empirical studies of contracts to pursue it even further than I've done, but so far I haven't gone there.
Well, we will look forward to seeing what else you end up producing with these projects. What we can learn about cheese contracts. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me today, Gordon.
Thanks, Nathan.
I'm always interested in your responses to Law Talk. You can email me at nboman@wm.edu. You've been listening to Law Talk, the Legal Scholarship Podcast. Technical support is provided by William & Mary Law School. Our theme music was written and performed by John Schmidt. You can find more of John's work online at www.johnschmidt.com. That's J-O-N. And you can find Law Talk online at www.concurringopinions.com.